I'll put a little saying up here by Einstein I found in a book. I thought it was kind of interesting. If at first the idea is not absurd, there is no hope for it. You know, if you take an idea that you, if everybody waited till you had an idea that was for sure, you would never have a fresh one, would you? So I thought about that when we did our, in fact, it was out of one of my books on the City of David. Reminds me also of the story that a pastor, I won't mention his name because he's not our kind, talked, and he's a possibility of thinking pastor, you don't have to figure out who that would be. He said of a student that walked into a classroom after the class had started and there were two problems on the board that were the test. And so he sits down and works on the problem, and you know, it's an hour long test. So he finishes one of the problems and didn't get around to finish the other one. So he apologized to the teacher. As he left the room, he said, I didn't have time for the second one, but I did get the first one done. And the teacher said, well, you just solved the problem that no one else ever did. So not knowing that it was not solvable, let him put his best juices to work. So I thought about that. So don't worry about attacking the impossible, because you never know, what seems impossible may be a possibility after all. Well, welcome to our study on Eretz Israel. This is lesson 67. Got probably six left, so I should have counted that. We'd make it exactly, you know, some funny number. It's not going to worry about that. We are talking about the City of David today, and very difficult for me to present a cogent lesson to you, because we're dealing with at least 2,000 years of time. Actually, you go to our day, you're looking at 1,500 years of time. 3,500 years of time to go back to the temple or to the tabernacle. And there have been two destructions, major destructions of Jerusalem. And it's been built over now in the 20th century. And now you're supposed to come back and figure out what happened there. So you always have to, you know, try to have people understand what years we're working with, what was present at that time, what size the temple would have been. Those kind of questions come up. So I'm going to do the best I can to explain as best I can how I understand it. And maybe if you get a little bit out of it, I'll be happy. So what you have here is a drawing, I guess it is, of the City of David. And as it is usually construed, with the temple off to the north in its own compound. So we have in the bottom here, we have what's going to be called the spring house or the spring tower. This is where the Gihon spring is. And my theory, my supposition is that the temple is going to be mounted or built somewhere out in this area. And the northern part of the City of David would have been somewhere around here. And so the city itself would have been something like this, with this outside the city wall. That's why it's been built out there, to protect the water source. So without telling you what I'm going to tell you, let me tell you what I'm going to tell you. Yes.
Is that where they're digging now?
Yes. They are digging mostly here and here. And this tunnel, it's called the water tunnel, from here, you now can walk it underground all the way up here to what is now considered the Temple Mount. It's a water drainage system. It's down the Tyropine Valley, or the Cheese, or the Central Valley, sometimes called. So most of the digging goes on in this area here. There are other places. I got one map that shows you where they're digging, and the maps aren't always very clear to read, so you know, hard to bring it to you. But that's the answer to that question. Pardon? No, the Jewish quarter is inside the city walls. This is Salwan. I just showed you the spring tower down here. All right, now that's where we're going to see here. I just showed it as a way up here. And this is in the Kidron Valley. I show it down the Gihon Springs. I don't show that spring house over it, but the spring house was built to collect water and actually raise the water level to certain places. And actually, I didn't bring in a picture of this either, but they would let this water out along the Kidron Valley, and they would have pipes, apparently. Some of this is conjecture, but they would water that valley, the Kidron Valley, the water for the crops. So that water source is a huge thing for Israel, for Jerusalem and for Israel, because without the water source, they never would have built here, never would have made this their capital. So we're going to talk about the lost city, and it's not Atlantis, but I do think someday they'll find Atlantis, because I think the ocean levels have risen and have buried a possible Atlantis. I'm not sure that I would totally agree with that, but we're not going to talk about the Atlantis, but we're going to talk about the lost city called Zion. Our presentation tonight may be vexing and exciting. Vexing because so much information is lost about the city at the center of God's creation. Exciting because there's a startling amount of new information that's coming to light about the city of David. So you have, you know, both going on. At the right, we have the popular view of the city of David, which I mentioned to you, with the expanded Jerusalem, which would be this section here we call Upper Zion, that is there as we see it today. And it's still within the city walls. In our extended study of the land of Israel, we are closing in on the last sessions. I think we said there's six left of our series, ending in the broader city of modern Jerusalem. Since God revealed himself to the nation of Israel, I'd say primarily here, in this place, the land has become the most controversial real estate in the world. Now, if we focus on the location of God's work, we talk about where does God make himself known. We start with the universe he created. We narrow it to the earth, to the land, to the city of David, to the temple, and to the Holy of Holies in the temple. That's how specific God has been in his revelation of where he can be met. And that spot is called the mercy seat. And this was found in the temple. It was also, first of all, set found in the tabernacle, which you see a picture of, which was a portable, I call it a building, but device they could take down and move with them in where, when they were in the desert. And then it becomes a temple that's permanent under Solomon's reign after David. And then we have the destruction of Solomon's temple in 586, and then it was rebuilt, finished around 515, called the Zerubbabel Temple. And then we have Herod's temple, which is a renovation of Zerubbabel temple. So we usually talk about the first and second temple periods, although you well know there are other temple renovations that occurred that are minor and are not counted. Now, just for space, because this space becomes somewhat of an issue in our study, the tabernacle, as you see it, is 75 feet wide and 100 feet long, and that's 11,000 square feet. And if you want to know how big that is, well, it's about the size of our auditorium. Our auditorium joists span 100 feet. Take off a couple of hallways on either side, you're back to around 150. It's about 200 feet side to side. You take off the side, and you pretty much what is inside the auditorium, the tabernacle would have fit in that space. And so the temple is a link between God and man. This is in the Jewish system. You know, we have a temple not made with hands. Losing this space, the temple space, is like breaking a link. You know what that is in your computer talk. The people are lost. Note that God presents himself in a material world to the Jews. Now, I'm very fascinated by this fact that Christians over the centuries have run away from the physical world to the spiritual world. God doesn't. He has created the material world. He created the humans to be the crown of his creation, and he put them in a material world, intending that that's where they would stay. So we have no idea of going somewhere else. The Jews never had any idea of going somewhere else. So the material world is the world of the Jews and is the only world promised to them. Bad spelling. So above we have just a picture of Herod's enlarged temple and not the small temple we talked about earlier. Now, one of the lessons that God is, that one of the lessons is that God is the God of the material world, which is what we understand. Thus, material is not evil, as the Greeks thought of it. God created it, and thus it is not evil. Satan cannot change its intrinsic value. Therefore, I say it will remain for eternity. So, I mean, this has to do with the Jews and their temple. It's a physical space. Last week, we spent most of our time talking about the accepted location of the temple marked out in yellow. We said that the Temple Mount, and it's called the Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary, I suppose Aramaic, cannot be located they cannot be the location of the Temple Mount. I just say flatly, cannot be. Now, ironically, it is the Roman army headquarters housing the Praetorium, near the palace for the Roman governor, Pilate, for example, when he was in town, and the home of the 10th Legion. Now, I show you two pictures. One is from Masada. It is the camps that house the same legion, both of them, the 10th, was the 10th, occupied both these places. The 10th Legion occupied both of these places, and you get an idea about the scale mostly by just looking at the size of the roads. You know, if I put a man down there, you wouldn't be able to see him. So you see the roads on the bottom here, and you see the roads here, and you see that's kind of in scale. And you see that this Roman encampment at Masada corresponds nicely with these, 35 acres over here in Jerusalem. So rather than this being the Temple Mount, it's actually the Praetorium camp and the home of the 10th Legion. Now, we believe the evidence that Jesus and the prophets said that destruction would be total. He said, not one stone will be left upon another, which will not be torn down. And we also supported by presenting witness to that fact that it had been totally destroyed. This is not in the Bible, but these are extra-biblical witnesses. So if that's the case, the next question is, if not here on the Haram al-Sharif, then where? So this week we answer that question, or make an attempt to. If the temple location is difficult to place on the Temple Mount, there is an equally enigmatic or mysterious truth about its correct location in the city of David. But we have an idea because we have evidences of it being located. I mean, we can't probably go to the spot and say this is where it was. Now remember that the singular evidence offered by those who support the Haram al-Sharif as the location of the temple, and you should say this by heart, is that the Jews would never have lost track of the temple location. Today they say it is on the Temple Mount. Jews would never have lost that place. I mean, they all give that answer. However, while we believe that they have lost it, it is or was a hard case to make because it's a case made from silence because there's no one witnesses says, well, we forgot it. No one said that. No, we didn't forget it. We remember it. So you got to prove them wrong by a silent witness. So the question whether the Jews could lose track of the temple location was unbelievable and thus in some minds a standoff. Thus, it has remained as an accepted position of virtually all archaeologists, theologians, guides, authors, artists, illustrators, publishers, cartographers, cardiologists. You know, sometimes the speller thinks you know what you want, and if you don't look what he gave you, that's not what I want. Cartologists, amateurs, professionals, Christian or secular, they all agree on this point. Now, a little known fact to the modern reader is that up to 150 years ago, everyone, remember everyone, all those guys, everyone, everywhere thought that everything happened in Jerusalem, that is the city of David, within the Ottoman walls of Jerusalem. And I marked those off for you can see with your eyes, the yellow area. Everything that everybody thought happened in those lines. There wasn't a thought that it was anywhere else. So now we enter the city of David, 1867, Civil War days. Seems like a long time ago, but in archaeological finds and digs, it's not that long ago. So this picture is a drawing from a guy that died in 1854. The picture is not 1867. It says to enter, we're going to start picking up city of David in 1867. But you have here a picture of the what we call Mount Zion and the Kidron Valley down this way. This would probably get kind of mixed up here. I think this has to be Gehenna, and the Tyropene Valley would have to be up in here, and it joins here, and they all join down here at the bottom and off to the Dead Sea. So you see it's kind of a, now again, it's an artist, so there's going to be some exaggeration here, but we don't know this. The amount of olives looks pretty reasonable. If anything, it's a little bit too high. The city of David is a lower mountain than the ones around it, which allows it to have a spring in it. What happened in 1867? Well, before I tell you that, there's Anarina Haman is a gal that appears on a video who is an outreach coordinator for the City of David, said of the City of David, the old city, which I'm pointing to over here, and she's standing up here talking. This is the place where you start if you're going to see the City of David. You take an overlook and you look back to the north and you see the city, old city wall. The old city is the home of the ancient biblical Jerusalem. And up until 150 years ago, everyone thought that the ancient biblical Jerusalem lies within the confines of the old city right behind you in the wall. Within the walls there, she's pointing. And I draw those out for you. She's standing about here, you know, and she's looking this way, those walls. And I drew a line somewhat around City of David. Again, it's hard to see exactly where the valleys are because they've all been filled in. Again, that makes it difficult a little bit to explain things because they're not as clear as it ought to, as might like it to be. Well, she went on to explain that the City of David lay hidden for nearly 2,000 years, and that's a little overstatement if you look at it carefully, but that's what she said. For 2,000 years until the British archaeologists began to discover discoveries continue to this day. In 1867, Warren came to Jerusalem to excavate the Temple Mount. And I thought, no doubt, that he had visions of temples dancing in his head because he came to see the temple. There were also rumors about gold in them there hills, Solomon's gold in the temple. You know, these kind of rumors get out there, especially in those days when nothing was verifiable, kind of like today. Nothing is verifiable. Anyway, we have this thing, and so, but the Muslims, who were in control, they were there until 1918, but the Muslims were not excited about anybody digging in their territory, especially near their mosques. Further digging may reveal their fraudulent narratives about the Temple Mount, besides. But Warren did not come all the way to be disappointed. He being denied digging on the Temple Mount, secured places on land purchases by Rothschilds, I believe, in the place that we know today as the City of David, so he could tunnel down and perhaps, even some suggested, underneath the mount. If I can't get you this way, I'll get you another way. Remember, they're looking for evidence for the temple. By the way, just as interesting here, Yemen Jews were settling in this territory in 1882. That's before Herzl started Zionism in 1897 in Switzerland. Not Switzerland, France. And later, in 1936, these Jews were expelled by the Muslims, the Arabs, in their revolt. So the Jews were there even before the Zionist movement started. That's just an aside. Where did they go? City of David. Interesting. Okay, but as Warren dug a shaft, and I don't know how deep he got, on the south of the Temple Mount, he discovered what carries his name today, the Warren Shaft. And this is hard to see, isn't it? All right, so here are ruins. See those ruins? Those are very significant ruins. Some of those come from the time of David. Some of them come even from Canaanite times. And somewhere up in here is where Warren did his digging. And you can't see the Temple Mount, but it's right off to our right. And I don't suggest he dug this deep. I don't know how deep he got before he ran into something. The shaft is still there. Well, in a sense it is, because it's what he discovered is there. So this Warren shaft is not what he dug, because it looks to me like the Warren, the thing that he found actually comes right onto the grade, which is another interesting to look at. All right, so here we have the same place. I'd probably a little closer up, didn't help much. And even closer up yet. And here we have that little place where the gal was talking about. And we go down in here, we go down into the bottom here, across this way, and you go through this whole period, if whole area of what's called the City of David is part of the tour. So this is the Silwan Visitor Center, the City of David Visitor Center, that you have an appointment to get to because it's so highly traveled. Now, remember, the best argument for the Haram el-Sharif location is that the Jews would not have lost track of the temple location. Remember that? Can you say that by heart? Remember that we had no way of confirming such a mental lapse. Remember, we had no way until we are told that the Jews lost track of the City of David. A Jew told us that they lost track of the city of David for 2,000 years. That's overstatement, but let's take her word. So if the city can be lost to the Jews and everyone else, why would anyone believe that the Jews would never lose the temple location, which is a smaller object than a whole city? It seemed to me like the Haram el-Sharif location thus have been totally discredited as a location for the Jewish temple because the Jews could not, did not, no way kept track of the Temple Mount. They lost track of their own city, which is where the Temple Mount really is. Now, Jesus said the temple would be destroyed and its foundations, and so it was. Micah said the city would be plowed and nothing be left, and so it was. And we have eyewitnesses that testify to the truth of a full destruction. Now, finally, the Haram el-Sharif has only collective memory as support that it housed the Jewish temple, but it is readily apparent that the Jews indeed could have and did, in fact, lose track of the location of the temple. Ironies of ironies, people still believe that the Haram el-Sharif housed the Jewish temple and are still looking for the camp of the 10th Legion. I think it's absolutely hilarious. Now, maybe you're a slow adopter, which is fine. And this is part of the whole thing for me is how do these things happen that we come to recognize an error and not throw the truth out with it? You know, that's a difficult thing. So notice in this original picture, the odd placement. Now, you know a little bit what you know. A little odd placement of the temple on the edge of the city. See up there at the ends of the arrow? Odd placement of the temple. The most treasured thing in any community is its church or its temple. And where did they put it? Out in harm's way. You know, north was the only place that Jews really had to worry about enemies coming. Where did they put the temple? North? I mean, just like, that doesn't make sense, Dad. All right, so committed are these supporters that they show their bias by drawing these grotesque arrangements of the city. And again, I noticed the arrangement of the temple and the distance to the Gihon Spring. So here's the Gihon Spring, and if the temple was here, and I believe that by hydraulic shutting off this Gihon, they could force the water, because it's low, they could force it up into the temple. So you'd have to carry these buckets of water up for these sacrifices. In fact, we have witnesses in 200 BC that actually said that's what happened. And to force water from this part up to here, pretty tough. So here's my teaching moment. You come for more than just a lesson on City of David. All right. It is very hard to dislodge an idea that is false. You think that a false idea, it's so false. I mean, you obviously get rid of it right away. No, you can't tell the difference between a false idea and a true idea sometimes. That's why we have the written word that drives us to prove something rather than by feeling. So it is hard to dislodge an idea that is false but accept it as true in spite of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. So the challenge is not to throw out the truth when sorting out the error, nor is it acceptable to retain the error for fear of throwing out the truth. So it takes a little skill, so to speak, mentally, you know, discipline to figure this out. That's what we tell people when they read the Bible. What does it say? Well, it says this. Well, then your mind has to be strapped to that idea. It can't be otherwise. So the error can be viewed as, now this is how I think the process works, because error can be viewed as truth in spite of the evidence. I know it's true, but it just doesn't seem right. It just doesn't seem right. Well, they say, well, how do you explain this? Well, perhaps the hesitation is that the presenter is biased, like me, and not presenting all the facts. That's possible. Or even if the presenter has done the best he can, he failed to account for the information that he could have known that's not even known to him. So, but if he knew everything, then he wouldn't have that view. That's possible. And that always is a possibility that you made a mistake. So, but that's the process. The city of David, Zion, Jerusalem, my holy mountain, all the same place. Called Salem, called Jebus. So we can't recap a little bit. Nothing wrong with repeating. Until October 24, 1867, everyone that was alive believed that the city of Jerusalem was contained in the city of David, also known as Zion. But remember, that's Jerusalem. All that was known of Jerusalem lay within the walls of Jerusalem. No one had ever, for whatever years, ever considered anything else. So effective has this stumbling block been that over 150 years later, 150 years ago, some, most, still believe the tale. We have 150 years to figure this out. Still haven't bought it. Although it is conceded that the Upper Zion, the western part of the city, this part is Western Zion, they concede that as a New Zion or Upper Zion or Western Zion. They concede the Upper Zion, the western city on the hill, was part of Jerusalem in its enlarged configuration from Hezekiah's time. Okay, well, this word becomes dicey. I look at these pictures, and I know what they say, but I don't know what they mean. I mean, I'm a kind of graphic guy, can see stuff, but it's still very difficult because you show a picture like this, you don't have three dimensions, you just got two dimensions. So what you have is not only do you see it flat, but it also does this. All right? And when you look at a map, well, where does this go? It's very difficult to follow. So I'll do the best. October 24, 1867, Charles Warren, head of the Second British Palestine Exploration Fund, and there were a lot of those expeditions because Britain was in control. Not weren't in control of the area, but they were the British had interest, I should say, in this area because there a lot of Christians came out of Britain. As I said, dug and found what is called the Warren Shaft. Now, the Warren Shaft you see on the right, on the left, I'm sorry, it is not apparently a dug shaft. It is a sinkhole. Apparently, it's been something soft in there, and with water, as we have talked about being round, it probably finally all either washed out or it became an empty funnel or empty tube through which water came up to the temple, you know, because it goes, this is the Warren Shaft, you see. And the temple's up here somewhere, let's just say. Maybe it's here, because here, this is where it discharges out into the air. So you have this space. And then you go down to the Canaanite Pool, which is a collection of water from the spring, which is from below, and it's pushed up and it's kept in these pools, apparently. And some, when it overflowed, they would go down and water the Kidron Valley. Now, it's interesting when you look at this, they, you know, make a lot of guesses. They think that the first was dug like this. See, the floor is level, pretty level, and the roof is like this. Then all of a sudden, you look how it actually is. The floor still goes this way, but the floor goes down. Roof goes this way, but the floor now goes down. So what do you think? Well, they dug it two different times. Why would they dig a roof or room with that high ceiling height just for the fun of it? You know, rock isn't easy to dig. So they assumed that they dug this, and somehow they found this nexus, and it led them to dig out to it. So this now becomes a walking path. They thought for a while that they drew water from the shaft, you know, by buckets, and but that's been discounted because it's not a straight down drop, so your bucket would be always sliding on the side. And the second thing is the water that's at the bottom of this is not deep enough to bail. So they have all kinds of guesses now what's going on. But this is what the Warren Shaft is, this thing here. But he discovered all of this. He discovered all of this, this way, and this probably has now been ruined, but they reconstructed. And this shaft here is what you're seeing here. Okay, if I say too much, you'll be confused. If I don't say any more, you'll be confused. I'm dead. I'm just. Now, somebody asked about where are they digging. This is a picture of where they're digging. So we have, if you drive into the Dung Gate, the road's about up here, and you see to the left, you're driving to the west, you look to the left, and there's a dig there, and it's called a parking lot dig. And so that's what that one is. The Palace of David dig is here. I have it labeled. And then we have the Warren Shaft that I talked about. I think that probably is not where he dug, because what he found, that crooked thing, is this thing. It makes a hook like this, you know, but we don't see the hook when you look at it flat. And then we have the spring down here, the spring house down here where the water actually comes out and the water is collected in these pools, which like you have here. Okay. So when we were standing there, the lady was talking about looking into the city of David and saying everything was in the side of the Jerusalem walls, that spot would have been approximately here. And there's all the digs down here. Down here is the Pool of Siloam and the underground water drainage system is this line here. I know it's difficult. A little bit better picture of the spring tower and the tower pool, the Canaanite wall. See, Canaanite goes back to the Jebusite time, and this is the shaft. This goes, I think, outside, and this is the, you know, tall enough to walk in. And there's Warren Shaft. You know, now you see it's actually got a kick in it, and it dumps out into this Canaanite pool. So I think the water would have been blocked up here, would have rose to this point, and it would have been raised back up there to the temple. That's a supposition, because that way the water could have been in the temple flowing like a spring. So the discovery of this, the sinkhole, and other confirming finds caused Warren to conclude that he had found the city of David, the lost city, before 2,000 years. Another picture of it. Now, the Keown Spring doesn't come out from the side of the mountain. It more or less bubbles up from below. And it gets into these compartments that fill up. And if you close this off here, see, the water wouldn't run out here ordinarily, but you close this off, seal this off, this water has to go back up this way all the way up to the temple. Okay? So the pressure would have been there because it's, again, a lower part of the mountains that are around them. Now, you might want to ask about Hezekiah's tunnel, which was done in Hezekiah's time. Joke. You find this here, and it's at the real lowest level. And it took water from the Gihon Spring across to the west and south down to the Pool of Siloam. In the meantime, you see here in the Kidron Valley, you see these crops that are growing here. And a lot of the steps would have been up here to get to the top. So it would have been quite a hike. I noticed one of the maps had elevations, and I kind of forgot what they were. But we're talking about hundreds of feet from the bottom of Kidron Valley up to the top of the city of David. I drew on a map over there, Zion, Mount Zion. That's a cross-section of this spot where I have north. So it's looking north. And in order to build on top, and Josephus will say this, as in order to build on top, the top was rounded enough or small enough that they couldn't hardly build anything. Remember, the whole city was only 13 acres. Maybe you didn't know that. It's only 13 acres. We have 20 acres of church here, so a little less than our church lot. And so in order to build up there, they would have to fill in the top, and then to fill in, you got to build up walls up. We call them retaining walls, and some of those retaining walls still exist. That Canaanite wall still exists. So these walls now are built, and Josephus says, this part I had trouble with. I told you last week, how in the world can you have something that's 450 feet tall when we think about our capital is 400 feet tall? The Giza pyramid is a little over 400 feet tall. And so we have that kind of height from the bottom of the Kidron Valley to the top of the city of David or top of the temple platform. But that's the number he gives. And sometimes we say, well, they just couldn't have built big things like that. Well, they did build a lot of big things. And I told you they shaved down the hill over here, the red line, the cut down line. They shaved that hill down. That took a few buckets of dirt out of there. So if you have enough people, enough patience, and enough slaves, you can get the job done no matter how big it is. And they have sometimes years' time to do it. Okay. Now, after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD and the full destruction of the city in 135, the location of the temple was lost or in some cases ignored. I think there's some softness here as to who lost it and who remembered it. Even the city of David, Zion, lost its recognition and assumed only the upper city as Zion's space. So we might say this is upper Zion, and I don't know how to compare this to be like the modern news today. Everybody knows what the news says is the way it really is, right? We've learned that already. So the news says this is upper Zion, and by the way, the specialist would say, oh, well, no, that's not really quite true, because there's really another Zion down here, but we don't talk about it much anymore because it's kind of out of vogue. And furthermore, as I'll say in a minute, Christians have come in and they've usurped some of these spots and made them Christian rather than Jewish, so we're not going to talk about the old Zion. But really when I get down to it, there's some people knew about this, because when the Jews came back from Yemen, they knew where to go. They didn't go to any other place except the city of David. So the Christian church, and this is another one of my, if I have a pet peeve, it is one of these. This is one of them. The Christian church, the Holy Sepulchre, was built in Zion. And it was considered a Christian temple, and it intentionally usurped the Jewish temple. In fact, they call it Solomon's Temple. Now we're talking about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And that further confuses the little children that are growing up in grade school. Mommy, where are we going? We're going to Solomon's temple. Confusing. Now, this is my axe to grind, and that someday I'm going to learn about this and teach about this. There's books out on this. Got to put it together. We don't understand this because this becomes the basis for covenant theology. They kick the Jews out of the Bible, and they put the Christians themselves back in their place in the Bible, and we got nothing but chaos in the world and nothing but chaos in the Scripture. So look what they did. So great was the early church Christian animus against the Jews and anything Jewish that they made an effort to confuse and obliterate anything Jewish, including the location of the temple. Remember the Christian Easter calendar, our calendar, we're going to observe here, third week in April, I think it is, constructed so that it was not on Passover. And I've often wondered about that. It's a Passover event. Why is our Easter not on Passover? Because they did not want to share a holiday with the Jews. So what did they do instead of organize it according to the Old Testament pattern, which is how Jesus died on Passover? They organized it by the moon. That's how we know when Easter comes. It's a circle. You know how the speech goes. So when the first significant church building was built, and I'd say that's probably the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, because Helena, Constantine's mother, came in about 325 and looked for a place, a suitable place, looked for relics, could before they were gone, and picked this spot. This is the spot that she decided was the place of Christ's crucifixion, his burial and resurrection, which is called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, in the Christian quarter, inside the walls today. When the significant church building was built, it was built in Jerusalem, claiming it was the Temple of Solomon. Even the trappings of form worship began to occupy the worship services. And they were conducted in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Now, if you go into a Catholic church today, and they're meeting over there, anyway, we have the Catholic Church, we have the Lutheran Church, the Episcopal Church. If you wonder where all their vestments and their form worship comes from, maybe you thought about it, it all comes from the Old Testament. So they take the Jewish stuff and put them in a Christianized version. Do they have a mass? Do they have an altar in the church? In fact, how many times have I had to talk about what is what we call the communion table, and the church has called it an altar? And how many times you see it in high churches, the chancel is split, you got the pulpit and the lectern, and up on the stage you have the altar. And then we get real Christian and spiritual, we put a Bible on it. But it's an altar. It's an altar out of the Old Testament. The Christians have tried to take the Jewish pattern and Christianize it. They did it with the church. All this to deliberately draw attention away from the original temple site, which is on the eastern slope of the city of David, which became the garbage dump of the city. That's why I think they did not lose track of the temple site, because they dumped their garbage there. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre not only mimicked the 10-degree angle, by the way, the Temple Mount also has that angle on the north wall, south wall, 10-degree angle of the reconstruction attempt of the temple twice, once in 325 in the time of Constantine, because of his, I should read right out here. But it did not stop there. Virtually all early Jewish traditions regarding matters associated with the temple worship, whether true, mythological, emotional, or symbolic, were appropriated by the Christians in the time of Constantine and associated with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The early Byzantine Christians even adopted some of the rituals of the former temple into their liturgy. They also brought over most of the Jewish historical and religious traditions and myths concerning the site of the temple and made them to be part of the church, from the temples in Jerusalem forgot, from Martin. Now, with the absolute destruction of the temple and the city, except for a couple of attempts by the Jews, one in 325, approximately under Constantine, remember he issued in 313 an issue of toleration for all religion, and the Jews says, we got a chance. And they went to start building their temple. Where did they go build it? In the city of David. Another attempt was made, and Constantine, by the way, stopped them after a while. Another attempt was made with the approval of Julian the Apostate. Now, this was against Christianity. Julian was an apostate against Christianity. So he allowed the Jews to build to spite Christians. But the earthquake stopped that one. Now, it didn't destroy it completely, because the ruins apparently stood there for centuries. You know, especially the west wall of the Holy of Holies. They knew where that was. Again, the 10-degree issue again. And that was in 363. And no further attempts were made to rebuild the temple, although the ruins remain of this effort remain visible for centuries, apparently. The western wall of the Holy of Holies, get this, becomes the western wall transmigrating to the Temple Mount. And they also call it the Western Wall. So when you read the old time talk about the Western Wall, it's the Holy of Holy Walls. It's now becomes the Holy of Holy. It's next to the Holy of Holy Walls, but still called the Western Wall. So we say for 1,500 years, the location was virtually lost by the mainstream people. It remained so for many, until the water system was discovered in the ancient city of David in 1867. My editorial comment, I do not think Zion was totally forgotten. Couldn't be. Since the Fortress of Antonia was not confused with the temple site until after the Crusades. The city of David became the trash dumping site, partly or largely due to its association with the temple and the Jewish people. See, that's why they quite all forgot it. But those that knew it didn't want it to be rebuilt, so there's no talk about it. Anti-Semitism was rampant in the early church. Jews had lost their home, their temple, were virtually friendless in the world until a few Christians began to read their Bibles and notice Jewish promises were still unfulfilled, and we know this from English literature, English after the Reformation, especially the English Reformation under Henry VIII. He, in fact, even published his own Bible, tied it to the pulpits in England, and people started to read it and said, ah, what have we missed? And the truth was out. It still took years and years for this to become impressed on the church, and some still scoff at it. So dumping garbage in the city of David was a statement about their knowledge of Jewish history. This is what I figured out. When Hezekiah enlarged the temple, the city, there's that time they moved some of these tombs out of the city of David and moved them up to the New Zion. I don't know why they did that. But that's why we're in New Zion when we go to the place where we actually go to the tomb, which is probably a joke. But anyway, we're in the right category of space. And those tombs that are down there, if you walk down the path after you come out of the tunnel from the city of David, there are tombs on the side called the Royal Tombs, and they say that's probably where David was originally buried. Now, we're going to talk about the city of David, a little bit of history. The Israelites entered the land in 1406. Israel was ruled by judges after Joshua died, and so we got somewhat like a 300-plus year period here with no central government. You know how this works. Somebody had trouble? It was a theocracy. When somebody had trouble, they had a disagreement, I got trouble with Bill, I go talk to one of the judges, and he solves it. And that's how everything was managed. And then they became prophets against Israel, you know, when they apostatized. Now, a king was prematurely, talking about Saul here, prematurely appointed for the Israelites these are my best dates, and I could have checked them. The dates there. And Saul lasted 40 years, but no dynasty ensued, you know. His children didn't sit on the throne. The next thing was the divinely chosen King David. We figure around 1000 B.C. He lasted 43 kings, all 40 years. Really easy to remember. Saul, David, Solomon, all reigned 40 years. David was a warrior king and subdued the enemies of Israel. In the task to unify the tribes into one nation, a capital of the nation, the seat of a royal administration was needed, and it would be best if it would be somewhat in neutral territory. You know, like between Kansas and Nebraska, you know, somewhere right in between. In order to not pick one tribal territory or another, Kansas or Nebraska, David, by intent or divine providence, probably both, chose a very small, well-defended 13-acre site that had been for 500 years, remained uncontested by Israel, the Canaanite people of the Jebusites, and they retained it. In other words, there was this land within Israel for 500 years. I thought, why didn't David go take them out? Well, I think they were sort of kept there for a reason. Not that David knew this, because he didn't live to 500 years. So I talk about 13 acres here. Our church grounds is 21 acres. So if you want to know how much 13 acres is, it'd probably be to the driveway to the south and everything north and everything to the east. That'd be about 13 acres. Well, you can see you put a pretty good-sized building on 13 acres. Our church sits on 13 acres. There's parking besides. So, you know, it's not that small, but it's not that big either. So for 360 years, a pocket of Jebusites were tolerated within the territories of the Promised Land, and I think we would say divinely kept in reserve for this day. David, for his reasons, decided that 5 miles from his home, 5 miles north from his home in Bethlehem, which is where he was from, in the city of Jebus, it would be his capital. So then courageous King David acted to acquire the site. 2 Samuel gives us the account. Now I'll give you the map, just how this works. Benjamin and Judah and Jerusalem is parked right there. Now, we don't need to think about lines like a meet and bounds like we have today. You know, you can go survey a site and you know within a half inch or a quarter inch or a tenth of an inch where your property is. These guys probably didn't have that kind of loot, that tight of boundary. So they said, this is Benjamin, this is Judah. And so they actually can almost carve out a space that's neither one, neutral. And so that's where it is, between Benjamin, neutral, and Benjamin and Judah, so that neither one could claim it. So that's really what I'm showing here. The location of Jebus is on the border of Benjamin and Judah. The site would have been very familiar to David as a place near his home that had never been vanquished. Now, this is what it says in 2 Samuel. Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. David said on that day, whoever will strike the Jebusites, let him reach the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul, through the water tunnel. Now, we're saying water tunnel here, and we're going to have a word that we don't know for sure what it means. We're putting two into the translators are actually putting two and two together, and this word tensor is the word, and that's something like this, perhaps. And so they kind of guess, well, it must be the water tunnel, and we keep that a little bit, because that fits what happens, but that isn't what is known by the translation. So it's a little bit of help from history that this word is used. These words, water tunnel, is used. But anyway, David knew about whatever it was. Now, when David is talking about let him reach the lame and the blind, he's mocking them inside the walls. David's mocking the inhabitants of the lame as the lame and the blind defenders of the fort. Thus, he's really claiming there's not much resistance inside. On the other hand, they say, they shout back at them, the blind and the lame shall not come into this house because that's what kind of guys you are. So the Jebusites are mocking David in the same way. Now the proof is who was right in the next verse. And David lived in the stronghold. That pretty well took care of it. And he called the city David. And it must have been a peaceful takeover to some extent because he buys the threshing floor from a Jebusite. He didn't vanquish all the Jebusites that were in the village. So he bought this threshing floor from him. He could have, as king, could have stolen it, but he didn't. We'll get into that in a minute. So David lived in a stronghold and called it the city of David, and David built all around the Milo and inward. Now here we have a problem. Now, what is the Milo, and which direction is inward? So we're going to somewhat guess at this and say the Milo is where it showed the house and so a dip there, and it's filled in. So it seems like the Milo was the filled-in space between two hills or two peaks. You fill it in to raise it up. And there are words like that when Dave explains what they did to level it up to the level of the street so they'd be level. And this is where probably the house of David was built. David built all around from the Milo inward. Inward, I don't know what direction that is. I looked it up and it's like, I have no help with this. So I think they punted and they said inward because it's a direction. Because I don't know what inward really means. Now, regarding David, it says that King Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David with cedar trees and carpenters and stonemasons, and they built a house for David. Now, remember, this is a political act here on the part of King Hiram, and, you know, David is a known warrior. So it's a good thing to be at peace with your friends, right? And so King Hiram, I'm sure, is doing this with David, so he's going to make peace with him and at least tell him he's not going to be a belligerent against them. So he sends this material to build this house. So David builds his house. And we would say, well, where would David build his house? Outside the walls? Not likely. So we say, assume he's building inside the wall. You know, we think of, there are things that are going to get associated together. Mount Zion, City David, the temple, the palace, the Milo and Acra, all these things are mentioned, and they all seem to be piled up in one location. All right, so he built his house, and I'd say most likely inside the city walls, because after all, inside the city wall, he's king, he needs protection. Now, the water shaft was found by Warren in 1867, and it must have been a shock when Warren realized that his find marked the location of the City of David. And I'm sure in his mind he had to say, is this possibly the location of the temple? If he thought it, he didn't write it. He should have thought of it, because it would be a monumentally important discovery. All right, now David has secured his place to live. And then 1 Chronicles 21 says, then the angel of the Lord had appeared to this prophet Gad to say to David that David should go up and build an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor. Now, if you want to be consistent with the proposition, going up would be from the dip, go up to where the temple would be on the hill. I think I had a name for that. I left at home. All these places have names. So the temple would have been up, or I should say the threshing floor would have been up from David's house. That's really what it says here. But you could go up from a lot of places, so it doesn't mean a lot. But David said, go up and build an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And David went up at the word of the Lord, and he spoke in the name of the Lord. And David said to Ornan, give me the site of the threshing floor that I may be able to build on it the altar, not the temple, remember, to the Lord. For the full price you shall give it to me. He's not asking for a special break here. Ornan said, take it for yourself. I'll give it to you. And David said, no, I don't. I like his best, one of best, David's best frames. He says, I will not take what is yours for the Lord, or burnt offering or offering which costs me nothing. In other words, he didn't want this to cost Ornan something, and it cost him nothing. I always think that's in our giving, that's always a real good test for us. Is our giving something that costs me something? You know, is it something I'm just giving up because I don't need it, or is it something that really costs me something? I think it's a good challenge here, because David wanted it to cost him, so he bought it at full price, and he gave 600 shekels. I have no idea how much that is. 600 shekels today would probably be $200. Probably not quite enough, but never know. So here's my little picture here, the threshing floor, David's house perhaps, up on the hill. Again, these are exaggerated. I don't know how big to make them. But that would be the day, and this goes up, and then actually later on this gets all cut down. And this goes on up to what we call the Temple Mounds, another little hump, and then it goes up to the rock that's under the Dome of the Rock. Yes, yes. Now, I would even allow that anywhere along the Mount Moriah Ridge, that could have happened, even on the Dome of the Rock, because it's all part of the Mount Moriah Range. Now, the highest spot would be where Jesus was crucified. If you want to go, well, he went to the highest spot. Well, that's where you'd have to go. No reason why you couldn't go there if you want to go to the highest spot. So I'm not going to die over the place, but anywhere along the ridge, this whole thing that we're looking at here, all of it is the Mount Moriah Range. It's just a ridge. It goes from up, down to up. Okay, now one more thing we have at this location. At least when I read it, I want to read it naturally. I don't want to force it. And the king said, this is about the crowning of Solomon at the end of David's reign. The king said to them, take with you the servants of your Lord and have my son Solomon ride on my mule. He's giving over the mantle. And bring him down to Gihon, the spring. Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet have anointed him king in Gihon. And they have come up from there to the city of David where they were rejoicing, so that the city is an uproar. Now, to me, this all fits nicely and compact. Now, if this is the right place, why would the people go up? The Temple Mount didn't fit here. It's because he went up into the city. And the Gihon Spring is the place where, associated with the temple, where the king would have been anointed. And it would have just been downhill from the temple. The temple. Well, Solomon hadn't built a temple yet. But where he's going to build it. I'm trying to watch the clock here. No one to cut. So when Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So we have connected here the house of David and the threshing floor, the future temple site, next to each other. And it just doesn't seem like it'd be a quarter or a third of a mile away, because it's not identified any other place. So another little argument here. In 1867, when Warren found the shaft, he also located the Gihon Spring, Hezekiah's Tunnel, 8th century, and other water channels that were part of the Canaanite and later Jewish irrigation system. But in 2005, a few years ago, Eilat, and that's a lady, I think, Mazur, amid opposition, declared that she had found David's house of cedar, 2 Samuel 5:11, because she found these bula with names that are in the Bible. Even the son of matches. And bulas are clay, fired clay, first of all soft, and then they get hard, and they become sealed. So these are, I'm pointing like you can see, these are sealed on this kind of like a manuscript. I don't quite understand how this works here. You think you'd wrap it around the outside, so how they're attached, I don't know. But these seals then would make this document secure. All right, so well, she found a bunch of these in a pile, you know, in a place. And it talks here about these seals are meant to seal documents. That's what Jeremiah 32:14 says. Now, the archaeologists discovered the remains of the royal archives. I think that's what we found here, royal archives down here. Remember, I haven't showed you much of this, but those outcropping rocks that are from Canaanite times, the Gihon Spring is down here. It's in this house that they found these bula. The archaeologists discovered the remains of the royal archives, the house of the bula, as it is called, may be the scribe's chamber that is mentioned in the book of Jeremiah 36:12. The building was razed to the ground in the Babylonian destruction, 586, to the ground of the Babylonian destruction, and all documents stored in that place went up in flames. But the bula, the clay seal impressions, what you see, that were attached to these documents were not lost. They just fell to the floor. And 51 bula were discovered. So it's almost like you found the library or the filing cabinet, all these documents. It's the largest collection ever found. 45 of these bula were inscribed with the ancient Hebrew writing. Many featured the names of biblical figures noted in the Bible. One scribe, however you say his name, read out the prophet's word to the people, beseeching them to repent. All this argues that the location of the temple and the archives were in the approximate location, not 1/3 mile north. Okay, so that spot I'm just talking about is here. And we started out our little trip here. So you walk down here and you walk down, you walk past as you keep on going. So these are Canaanite walls, and these are the part of the walls that kept back the dirt. Now, it's very, very difficult to put back in your mind, in your mind's eye, how this all was. Now we have Hezekiah's tunnel. It mentioned, you know, that was done to direct water from this side over to this side. And so they built this so this was hidden from the Assyrians when they besieged the city. And Hezekiah is credited with building that tunnel. We'll skip that. You know about that. That's here. And there it is. And this is the stone, the placard that was found here. It's right now in the museum in Istanbul, which when we were there with Randall Price, we actually saw the real thing. And it says that the two groups started from one end and met in the middle. And the question is, how could they do this? And probably the best answer is that they're probably following a crack, you know, maybe some damp or water flowing crack that they knew where to go. Because there's no technique on earth would they have been able to discover this. And then we have these kind of little unusual, this is the meeting place, by the way. So these little jogs don't really make a lot of sense unless they were following something. Leave that go. I think I'm going to stop there. I was going to say, there was one more thing I was going to say, but we'll have to wait that till next time. And you have people like Finkelstein, who's a Jewish excavator, archaeologist. He's called a minimalist. They don't think the Bible has anything to contribute. These are the guys that come out real, this can't be David's palace. Oh, no, no. Because they know that if this is David's palace, they know the temple's got to come with it. It's sort of the elephant in the room that no one mentions. I mean, no one said it. Well, if this is the case, then no one said it. They just said, well, we just found David's. Zip the lips for you. This is a picture from 1915 of the city of David. What's there? Nothing. It's farm ground. So this building here is still there. You walk by the Israelis, there's the Jewish people live there with this flag and amongst his Muslims. He's got courage. Yeah, there's nothing there. Now, what's really, really amazing is what you're looking at. You dig down another, let's say, 30 feet, and that's when you get to the level where David lived. 30 feet below this. And then we get the other fact that with this Simon, the Hashmonean, carved out the hill that was here. And it's gone because it's in this valley. It comes right through. This is the Tyropene Valley. Comes right through here. I mean, it looks so different than what you expected or when the Bible describes it, that it's like it almost becomes prophetic. When God says he's going to destroy a city, it's so destroyed. Like, was the guy, the Jewish commander said, that it's like you never saw a city. Like there never was one there. And you can almost see that. It's impossible there could be a city there. It's all gone. And so that's probably the argument, exactly what God said it was going to do. It's going to be totally gone. And this is 1915. And so, you know, for those 2,000 years almost since this, there never was anything here. There's not a good place to be.
When they were living.
That's right. And it's a very crude, uncut wall. You know, stones are laying in rubble form. But they're still there. Well, eventually got covered up. And when Catherine Kenyon, I should go through all the ones I've dug there. I think she's the one that uncovered them. And now they're there. Now these look, you know, kind of like normal. But if you think they'd never had another pile of dirt on them, and you would, like you have over here, you probably couldn't, on this pointing, like you can see, they're about here is where they are. But you wouldn't probably see them because they'd be all covered with dirt because they weren't discovered until middle of the 20th century. Now, let me show you another picture. Whoops. That's how it looks today. Since 1915. Well, let's all agree on where the temple is going to go first. This is no problem if you think these are the obstacle compared to the temple, the mosques on the temple. That would bring, of course, they could cause all kinds of trouble. But so somewhere, the temple is going to be in here somewhere about. I'll try to wrap this up next week. And I think we'll do I think the Holy Sepulchre, it ties in with the temple, doesn't it? Kind of like, we'll do that because it's a fairy tale in its own self. Okay. I'll let you go if I pray. Lord, thank you for the evening together. Again, Lord, for the wonderful God you are to us, for the wonderful God you have been to reveal yourself to, first of all, to the Jews who became the custodians of the scripture, passed them down to us, and Lord, we realize that as you came as their Messiah, they didn't receive you, but Lord, that delayed that reception just a bit until such generation that will come to receive you. In the meantime, Lord, we've been blessed as Gentiles to believe in you as our Savior, to be forgiven our sins. And now as Christians or students of the Word, student of history, we long to look into these things to help us understand the tasks that some of these people lived through and what was formidable to them and what they missed and what they should not have missed. Lord, all these are lessons for us to learn as well. Thank you, Lord, for teaching us mostly through the Word and through these historical lessons. We have insight even into your providence. Bless now as we go to our homes. Keep us safe as we go and bring us back in next week. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.